you know, I try and place myself as many places as possible. And like when it does come to sort of like building habits for myself, it's just like reaffirming relationships with people that I really respect. And that's ended up, you know, leading to this very nice life path that somehow seems to just keep opening new doors along the way.
We're back, Isaac.
We are back with another Block Studios. Here we go.
We are going to talk with arguably the most influential person, voice, in music NFTs currently. And so, Cooper Turley, we are excited to chat to him this morning. So, here we go.
Yo, what's up, guys?
Hey, how you doing, Coop?
Great. How you guys feeling?
Great. Thank you so much for jumping on.
Yeah, of course. I watched some clips from the last couple of podcasts. I love that you have my friend Andre on here.
Yes, Andre was so good. He's like the most famous person that no one knows. Like,
yeah, literally,
he's like done so much, and he has all those. Yeah, it's crazy. Where are you based? Are you based in the US?
Yeah, I'm in LA.
LA, how do you find it?
Love it. It's the best city in the world.
I guess it's perfect for the music industry, right?
Yeah, it's really good. Just got a lot of artist friends here. You know, good Web3 scene coming up. Beautiful weather. Great vibes, nothing to complain about.
And for our audio only listeners, it looks like he's going for the '90s Dwayne the Rock Johnson look, where he has the turtleneck and the chain around the edge. It's that classic.
I'd say
picture.
It's iconic.
Damn right,
it is iconic.
It's so good.
Yeah, I mean, we're gonna start ramping up the TikTok content, so you gotta, you know, build the brand to represent. So, you know, here we are. Whenever I don't wear this normally throughout the day when I'm just on regular Zoom calls, but if I'm hopping on a podcast,
that's my next question.
The turtleneck and the chain are coming on.
Love it. I had a question. I noticed I've watched a few of your interviews. Behind you, I can't quite see it because we've got like a narrow view, but I think you have like some sort of like animal play thing. Do you have like pets? What's the go with that?
Yeah, I got two cats. There's one sitting like right here next to me, and my other cat's sleeping on my bed across the hallway. But yeah, they're around. You know, you get some guest appearances every now and then.
Love it. Amazing.
So your name is Cooper. Your Twitter handle is Cooper Trooper. So I'll throw you a real softball here. Which character do you play on Mario Kart?
Oh, definitely Cooper Trooper. No, it actually comes more from I actually don't play that much Mario Kart. I played a lot of Mario Superstar Baseball growing up, which is like my favorite Mario game. But yeah, the name was like kind of a nickname that I had in college, and then used it as my gamer tag for a while, and then used it as my DJ alias, and then just kind of carried it over from there.
Yeah, cool. So speaking of the Twitter, we noticed that you also have a hexagonal profile picture. Does that mean that you have an NFT of your own face that you've made, and then that's been imported through Twitter?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to give myself too much credit here, but I think I was one of the first people to really just hop on like making your profile picture an NFT. So I would just like go and just mint it on Foundation, send it to my mobile wallet, and then just link it up, you know? It's kind of a nice way to like acknowledge that you're an NFT is that I'm going to choose like the tribalism of like one specific project, you know, like a little bit more open-ended, lean into the Web3 community.
That's bad. Okay, you mentioned there that I think you said something about DJ alias. So what's your background in music? Is it DJing? Did you play, you know, the violin? What's that for you?
Definitely did not play the violin. You know, I'm not going to go that far. My background in DJing is basically that I was on SoundCloud reposting a lot of music. I was a journalist for a lot of up and coming blogs, and then just was like, okay, well, if I'm finding a lot of music, I might as well try and put them all together into some mixes. And so early SoundCloud era, I was just basically making 30 minute to an hour mixes every week, downloading free downloads, and then just like running up a lot of, you know, interesting and exciting content. Most of those mixes actually are still up now on Audius. So if you go to audius.co/CoopaTrooper, you can listen to some of my old DJ mixes from the SoundCloud era about 5 to 10 years ago at this point.
That's great. Something that you wrote in Medium was, well, it was actually a tweet, and then I saw the article on Medium. Songs hit different when you own them as music NFTs.
Mm.
So something that I found like it's completely true. Listening to Weekend on a Tuesday by Rehab and Laid Back Luke, little plug there for another block. So after buying another block's first drop, you own a royalty of the ownership of the song. It actually is pretty true. It's like I own this small piece of the Spotify royalties here. So it's really cool. So what's your favorite NFT collectible, and why is that the best for you?
I'd say probably Daniel Allen's first one of one on catalog. You know, that's an artist that I've had like a long history with his Web3 artist career. He's crushing it and doing amazing work. So just being able to have some of those early gems are really special to me. And then just like broadly in that category, I was collecting a lot of songs that I had used either in my DJ mixes from like 5 to 10 years ago, or like, you know, tracks from friends that had been on Spotify or SoundCloud before. And so like my early collecting was really just like collecting memories, you know, like songs that I've had a personal relationship from many years past. I think that sort of shifted now into more like emerging artist waves. But yeah, just to give a quick story on that, like one of my first music NFT experiences was Mike Shinoda did a collab with Ian Dior for a song called Happy Endings. He put 10 basically music NFTs on Zora. Like this was before catalog or anything was ever around. I won one of those auctions. And I remember the next day, the song came out and it was the number one song on my release radar. And like when I streamed that song, I ended up having such like a emotional reaction to like knowing that I had this NFT that I was kind of immediately hooked. And from there, you know, I've been collecting ever since.
Wow, that's so cool. I think I listened to one of your, I listened to something or maybe it was a written article. And you talked about one of the first experiences you had where your eyes were open to music NFTs was, I think it was like a college lecturer or something like that. And the lecturer was like, he just mentioned off the cuff. I don't even know why, because it seems unusual back then for a lecturer to mention that. But he mentioned like this world where maybe artists would have a direct connection with the streaming. So like say a fan listened to their music, they could be paid directly as a result of that stream. Right now, there's a bunch of incumbent middlemen, you know, labels and stuff like that that make that not possible. Is that true? Is that sort of the first time you experienced it? And how could you see that playing out? Like, do you see a world where another block and Royal are maybe helping to solve that? Or is it a world where like an audience perspective where they're kind of like keeping everything on chain and being streamed on chain? Is it a combination of both? Is it separate? I don't know. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'd say it's a combination of all the above. And just to give some context here, I was going to school for music business. My senior year, one of my professors was talking about the future of the music industry. And one of the topics that got brought up was the advent of smart contracts and Web3. And so the concept was if I stream your track today, typically it's going to take anywhere from 3 to 6 months for you to get paid out on that. But with the smart contract, you could have two endpoints. If I stream your track right now, you're going to get that payment immediately after. And so to me, that just felt like a very efficient system. You know, that kind of led into the work I did with platforms like Audius, where you kind of have these very Web3 native streaming systems. You know, if I play a track right now and there's an endpoint receiver, they can receive that in real time. I think that the whole system around like owning royalties helps get us there. But to answer that question directly, I think that it probably will be a net new on-chain native streaming system where it's not trying to rely too much on like Spotify or SoundCloud or any of these existing platforms. You know, while I'm optimistic that there will be a world in which like Spotify's payment rails are on-chain, I think that that's very utopian. And so I think it's more likely that there is new systems designed to facilitate these payment channels. But, you know, you ask like, where are we at in that relationship? And I think in a lot of ways, music NFTs and collectibles are helping us get the vast majority of the way there. You know, like when I buy a music NFT from an artist and I pay 0.03 ETH, that artist is getting that ETH immediately. There's no escrow account, there's no middleman, et cetera. And so while it's not happening on like a pay-per-stream basis, this idea of having a direct relationship with an artist and be able to pay them in real time for consuming something that they release in a limited quantity, I think that's why I got so excited about music NFTs as sort of the next chapter of Web3 music, because it kind of facilitated those direct payments in the absence of us having to worry about establishing global streaming systems, which just have a lot more baggage associated with it.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's a great explanation.
That is great. It's going back to the idea of the vinyl and mixing that in with getting paid instantly, getting paid as opposed to getting paid in a 3 month cycle or a 6 month cycle. One thing that you have talked about before is that importance of buying that vinyl, burning a CD, making a playlist, and how every song can be accessed now through this $9.99 a month subscription. So I actually went to this fair last week, and there was this guy selling records for $50 each, and he was selling a lot of them, which was quite impressive. Do you think that it's more important to own something special with this sentimental value, or do you think it's more important to put something like streaming royalties, for example, where there's some kind of intrinsic cash flow in the NFT?
Speaking truthfully, I think the former is more important, because I think the vast majority of music listeners don't think about like earning a return on the music that they listen to. I think they just want to have an emotional relationship with the music they know and love. And so I think over a longer time horizon, I think it's one and the same. You know, I believe like all music NFTs will come with some form of ownership over the underlying track that it represents. But I think if we look at like the broader categories, I think it's more likely that someone wants to buy a digital vinyl than they want to like think about earning a fixed return on a song that they know. But I don't think that either are more important than the other. I think we just need to find a way to better integrate the two worlds together.
Gotcha. That's interesting. So thinking about people's adoption of the technology or their immersion into the industry, I noticed that a bunch of platforms, I mean, we talked about it earlier with Twitter, with your profile picture on Twitter and even Instagram and stuff like that, they're adding that verification to NFTs. And I think that's interesting because for people who previously were not exposed to it, they're now seeing even as simple as like the notification popping up saying you can now verify your NFT. And they go, oh, what's an NFT? Like, why do I need to be a part of this? And it's bringing that I guess the art scene into the forefront of people's minds on a mass scale, PFPs, right? Is there an equivalent, like in your mind, is there some sort of equivalent in the music NFT world where if we could get to that, like a PFP version, it would push it into the front of people who are not within the space's minds? And so sort of to broaden the awareness all at one time, do you think there's any kind of equivalent?
No, and I actually think that we shouldn't worry too much about like mass adoption of music NFTs in the short term. You know, I think that what's going to happen is there's going to be a new generation of artists who are using this technology under the hood. I think what's going to win is sort of like the music and the stories we're telling around the music rather than the tech itself. And so I think broadly, yeah, maybe there's a world in which you can have like a Spotify integration with music NFTs. That doesn't excite me very much. I think what excites me more is having more of a culture and a discovery and a curation world around the content that's being released in Web3. So for example, Hype Machine and SoundCloud, you know, like Hype Machine didn't need to focus on SoundCloud content and SoundCloud didn't need Hype Machine to work as a platform, but they kind of coexisted where there was like a layer on top of the music that gave it more sentimental value. And I think what I'm excited with Web3 is like, sure, you can collect these assets as limited digital vinyls, but more importantly, there's new artists who have not had a chance to be signed to a major label. There's like new paths to monetization with direct to fan relationships. And then what hasn't emerged yet, what I'm excited about, is sort of a new layer of discovery in your curation. Because in the past, you know, I was a journalist, I was doing artist interviews, I was writing about songs. You could get like some clout for like reposting a song, maybe get a couple followers on SoundCloud, you know in your mind that you were kind of first to discover it. But that wasn't really like a career path. It was more of like a social capital game. And so what I'm excited about with music NFTs is once we have broadly distributed content, you can start to create curation layers on top of it where those, you know, playlisters, those curators, those journalists, et cetera, can be making a living off of solely just like talking about and promoting the music that they love. And I think that ability to have more transparent payment mechanisms around like the curation of music, it's going to bring back this really interesting new wave of culture where we're getting away from like who's on New Music Friday to instead thinking a lot more about like who are the independent curators that are driving culture in the same way that people like Andre from Trap Nation were, like the whole Hype Machine crew was, or any of these indie blogs. I think that we really need that sort of reinvigoration of like emotion and storytelling around the music. And I think that Web3 has, you know, ultimately created a good canvas for that to happen.
Nah, that's so cool. One quick question, just because I thought it was interesting. Do you think there's any value in the kind of re-terming the name music NFTs to something else? I noticed that like, again, what you're saying is it's not that important that people adopt the technology, but just humoring me for a second, do you think that music NFTs create some sort of prejudice in people's minds? I don't know, because they've experienced something or that people have talked to them and it all sounds a bit hypey. Is there any value in being like, we're actually going to call it like music innovation now or something like that?
Yeah, it goes both ways. I mean, I definitely co-sign that like NFTs broadly do not have a great sentiment in the public eye. And so calling them music NFTs starts out in a very weird note. I'm optimistic that people will start to have a better relationship with NFTs. I think at some point in time, we can just drop the NFTs and you're just saying I'm collecting music and we don't have to like explain what that is. But I do think the one thing I want to counter that with is if you try and abstract it too much, you almost lose the culture associated with it. And so the flip side of like the average fan hating NFTs is that someone like myself that's like deeply integrated into this community in this scene, like that's very meaningful to me to like have this collection of songs and to know that they exist because of the fact that they are NFTs and that they exist on a public ledger that I bought using ETH. You know, like there's something very special about leaning into all of the nuance with that culture. And so I think broadly for mass adoption, yes, we need to think about abstraction. But I think the one caveat I would say there is if you abstract it too much, people almost don't recognize what they're getting into. And I think a big value out of being a participant in these economies is knowing that you're on the forefront of technology and of culture and sort of acknowledging that you're willing to jump through hoops to support these artists in the first place.
Yeah, smart. Love it.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I think that there's a lot there in terms of like that nuance. So every week since March, you've published this week in Music NFTs. So it's a weekly newsletter which shows the best things happening in the music NFT space. And Nathan and I are a part of music NFT space, so we're pretty aware of how niche it is, basically. And so one thing we've seen a lot is there's still a lot of projects launching and still doing well in the last few months, despite us going through a real bear market situation. So from what you've seen, is the outlook still positive on projects that are coming to you and that you're talking with?
Yeah, I would say we're broadly entering sort of the maturity state of Web3 music. I think for the last 12 months, it was kind of just like a canvas of everyone trying to launch whatever felt cool and exciting. But I think now we're starting to see like capital allocate towards ideas, communities, and projects that actually have some merit behind them. And so I would say the sentiment is definitely really, really positive. You know, like here in LA, like I go out to a party and someone will just like come out and talk about how they just get out of their label deal, how they're like interested about Web3 and music NFTs. And so like the culture and the timing around like independent artistry, I think, is reaching an inflection point, which dovetails really nicely with Web3. And then more mechanically on the ground floor, you know, sort of the practicality of these drops, I think, are coming more front and center. So beforehand, we had artists trying to do like, you know, 10,000 PFPs and trying to raise $1 million on the back of like some very vague idea. The most average music NFT collection today is 25 editions at something like 0.03 ETH, which is like $50. And so in aggregate, you're netting like, you know, $1,000 here for selling 25 editions to 25 random humans on the internet. But the paradigm there is that like, that's basically the equivalent of 500,000 streams. Most of these NFTs are being sold pre-release. So you now have a marketing budget or a production budget. And I would say broadly, I'm less concerned with like, how do we create new platforms to like bring 1 million new artists into the space? I'm actually like very laser focused on like what's happening on the ground floor with the artists that are using this every day, you know, with the artists that are tokenizing every single song that they're putting out and with the artists that like really care about this culture. And I think that the projects that I'm interested in, both from like an investment standpoint and from a collecting standpoint, are really just the ones that are participating in that culture and helping to spotlight sort of this new wave of emerging artists as much as possible.
That's awesome. Okay, cool. So, and to capture that, literally reading another Substack article that you wrote, and you were, I guess, bringing to light this new project that you're doing, which is Coop Records, which I think is pretty fresh. And so maybe could you just in a couple of sentences unpack it for us, the thesis behind it and what you're going after?
Yeah, absolutely. So Coop Records is a $10 million early stage venture fund investing in the next generation of music. What this means is investing in companies, artists, and NFTs that are exploring the intersection of music and technology. And to break that down even further, the vast majority of the fund is being invested into early stage companies. So think of this as like early stage Spotify, early stage SoundCloud, but whatever the next chapter of that looks like. A smaller portion of that is being invested directly into artists. And so this isn't a typical record deal. This is basically me thinking through new corporate structures for artists where they're basically rounding up their entire brand into a company and selling 5 or 10% of their equity to a long-term partner. And then last but not least is music NFTs. So if we think about the best performing artists over the next 5 to 10 years in the space, being able to allocate small checks to owning percentages of those artists' collection, we're saying like, hey, we want to be able to go and buy 5% of this artist's music NFT. You know, the analog here would be like, what would it have looked like if a fund owned like 5% of CryptoPunks or 5% of Bored Apes? And that's kind of like the pairing is like early stage equity in companies, early stage equity in artists, and then, you know, historical music NFTs that have brand sentiment and value for many, many years to come.
Great that it's like a three-pronged approach to capital allocation there. It's it is really cool, and it is what we love to hear, you know. So I noticed in the latest newsletter, so you angel invested into one project yourself, which was Peggy, I think, and you invested into another project as Coop Records, which was Relics. I saw on the Twitter announcement that was actually the first Coop investment. So seeing as though you've helped raise for two projects in the week, how often are you making these investments as an angel? Like, is that something that you're actually doing that often, or did two things just line up and you just talked about them? And are they only in music projects specifically?
Yeah. So broadly, I'm only investing in music projects right now, and that's happening through the fund. You know, that arpeggi round is something that came together about 8 months ago, and then we decided to just like announce the round this week. So like the timing was just funny because that round was closed like before Coop Records was even ideated, let alone like raised, let alone announced. And so, yeah, I mean, the arpeggi guys are absolute wizards. Like, they have an amazing engineering team. Absolutely love this idea of having like a song where you can sort of attribute every last sample down to its original creator and then all of the implications that come with that. And then, you know, on the Relics side, as a fund, you know, our primary focus is early stage companies. Relics is a company that had demonstrated to me that they're able to kind of identify Web3 culture. You know, this was spun out of Monster Cat, which is like one of the largest independent electronic music labels. The founders have been like really, really active in the NFT community over the last couple of months. And so for me, from the fund, you know, I'm always looking for the first time someone's raising capital. This was the first time that Relics was looking to raise capital. They kind of checked all the boxes to me from like a culture standpoint of just like understanding the day-to-day nuance of the space. And then as far as like where we get involved, you know, thinking through product roadmap, strategy, partnerships, et cetera, I really want to be in the trenches with these projects very early on to help them think about how they integrate with the wider music landscape. And if I had to like broadly kind of summarize my thesis with the fund, you know, I'm hoping to build out a portfolio that's very composable with one another. So what this means is like, if I invest in one project, I don't want to invest in something else that's competing with it. Like I want my two projects to be working together. And so is there an opportunity for me to plug in a platform like Relix with other platforms that are in my portfolio? So if you are an artist that's using Web3, I can say like, hey, here are like five different options that you can use that are all connected together. And in aggregate, it kind of creates this like mesh network where it's not about how you're streaming on Spotify versus Apple Music. It's like kind of this one aggregate artist economy. And the usage of that artist economy is what's underpinning the artist brand, which then makes that artist brand an investable vehicle that we want to participate from as the fund.
That's very, very good. It's actually really smart. Because I think one of the things, I think you studied accounting or something before music business writing, which shows because you've got some acumen there, which is really cool. But it's really smart because we talk to a lot of projects and sometimes it feels like there's a lot of siloed projects out there and you have to be sitting there on your laptop all day figuring out how to put all the pieces together. It, maybe as an artist, like how do I, you know, leverage all of this? If you can build a small ecosystem of sort of like verified projects, here's these projects that I think are going to be great. From an artist perspective, I'd just be following you and be like, all right, great. Whatever Coop's in, I should just follow that and use that. So that's really awesome. It like makes life a lot easier for an artist.
Yeah.
In regards to the fund, you're the GP. There's a bunch of LPs that you've got funding from, I'm assuming. Can you provide any background on them or is that a little bit anonymous? And if so, is there any world where those LPs would be involved with, you know, advisory for some of the projects or is that just really your job there?
I'd say it's largely my job, you know, just to give a quick like rundown on what the LPs of Coop Records look like. It's majority crypto investors. So this is either project founders or people who are running other crypto funds or, you know, active brands, influencers, voices in the space who have had like success just being in the Web3 ecosystem. You know, sprinkle in a couple high profile artists, sprinkle in a couple artist managers, and you kind of have this mix of like the majority of the capital coming from like Web3 investors and then a majority of the experience coming from like seasoned music industry people. But I would say broadly, the bet on Coop Records is like, hey, here's an asset class in music that's pretty niche right now. You know, here's a GP who's like spending all of his time on it. I have capital, but I don't really have like time to allocate. And so by investing in Coop Records, I'm getting exposure to this vertical that is like Web3 music without having to do a deep dive on it. And then the hope here is like for those crypto fund managers that are involved in the fund, we're investing in the first round of these companies. You know, the economics of it are made so that, you know, we're helping to develop them and really get them to a point where it becomes a serious viable investment for some of these larger funds. And then when that time comes, you know, hopefully the intent would be for like Coop Records to be the first check into your pre-seed round. And then when you go and look to raise again in the future, I have this network of, you know, more seasoned and established fund managers who can then be kind of like the, you know, lead investors in your next round that we can kind of pair up with and help to really level it up and take things to the next level.
It's great that we're pretty much talking to the future Y Combinator, future Sequoia, yeah. You know, and we got in on the ground floor, which is really cool. So you know, there you go. It's but it is legitimately kind of crazy that you can kind of take that we're in this point of history where we're taking the actual VC model, the actual thing that, you know, that's funding all these Airbnbs and Facebooks and whatever. And we're taking that and plugging it into crypto. And it's really in a point of time where it's actually working, which is really cool to be a part of. So this investment into that Coop made into Relix, it's about having a metaverse music player, basically. So is there anything, so basically it's a thing that plugs into Decentraland. Do you think that the public will fully ever embrace the metaverse? Because it's a little bit of an outlier subject at the moment. I mean, the people that are into it are really, really into it, which is really cool. So do you think that it'll always be this niche thing for a small subset of the population? And basically, is it a problem if it stays a niche thing? Or is that still a good thing?
I don't think it's a problem. I think it'll stay niche for many years to come. I think that most of the virtual worlds right now are just not compelling, which is why people don't use them. But I think it's, you know, we are going to have a very digital first world at some point in the future. And I think with a project like Relix, it's not about like, how do we distribute to Decentraland? It's like, how do we create a system to distribute music to all of the many virtual worlds that are to come? I mean, like even off the top of my head, I'm not going to name them, but I can probably think of like 15 different virtual worlds that exist out there today. And this is like with a total addressable user base of like 50,000 people. So when you start to scale out, I think there's a huge opportunity for that. And at least like from a broad set project perspective, again, going back to the culture, it's like when you're consuming content in these virtual worlds, how do you translate, you know, artists that are actually telling a compelling narrative here? How do you get, you know, music in there that actually helps to like translate the culture of what's happening? And so to your original point, I actually don't think it's a problem if it is niche for a while in the future, because that could be an advantage in and of itself. And what I've noticed time and time again is that you don't need to have like 10 million monthly listeners to have like a very, you know, successful or very active fan base. You know, I think the Web3 model has showed us that if you can get 10,000 holders to show up every day, you can create multi-million dollar economies. And so for something like Relics and just any Web3 music project, my intent with investments is not like, how do we get this project in front of like hundreds of millions of users? It's actually more about like, how do we get quality community members involved at like the most core way possible, and recognize that those are going to be our core value drivers. And if that so happens to populate out to 50 or 100,000 people, I think that's a nice win. But like, I think the core intent is just making this work and be a core part of someone's lives for, let's call it 5 or 10,000 people around the world.
Gotcha. That's cool.
One thing that not a lot of people are talking about now are DAOs. I feel like it's not as popular as a concept since that that US Constitution one came out, and it kind of became into the mainstream media a lot more.
Yeah, felt like the peak.
And yeah, that was definitely a lot more of a busy time for DAOs. But they're almost like, say, the Web3 equivalent of a company. And even in there's that DAO that's in the Midwest where they bought a big piece of land, and it's recognized as an LLC in the US, which is really cool. So I think there's a lot of really good uses for the DAO structure, as well as just like splitting ownership. There's all the hierarchies that you can input. There's the governance. There's a lot of specific things that you can write into the contracts, which can kind of help you operate as this company with all of these huge amounts of people, for example, all these collaborators. So do you think that most creative companies, or even your company as a VC fund, but particularly say like labels and producers and everything, could find better success if they ran as DAOs and they had all these collaborators kind of operating together in a DAO structure of shared ownership? Or do you think that the model of the classic VC can still be brought into this this new music NFT space and work like just as well or better?
Yeah, I think it's somewhere of a hybrid. You know, most of my relationships with DAOs have been equity-backed companies that have then launched a token and turned into a DAO. And so I think like starting from a DAO from day one is very difficult, but I'm not going to say that like every company should be a DAO, because I don't think they should be. And I think in many ways, the DAO is actually a lot harder to run than like a centralized company. I think where DAOs work really well is for very small niche communities. So if you have like 10, 20 people that all want to collectively share in some upside together, you know, putting 50K in a bank and like running that together, I think is really interesting. I think where this starts to get tricky is when you have hundreds of millions of dollars sitting in this like shared mutual treasury, there's all these investors and all these opinions, and it's very difficult to get anything done. So I think that the answer is really just somewhere in the middle. You know, in selective environments, I think it makes a lot of sense. You know, as it starts to scale, it gets a lot harder, but I think we'll solve those challenges. But I think broadly, just this intent that like we can create a vehicle where everyone has shared and collective upside in it, that to me is really exciting. And the fact that you can have that shared upside from an earlier stage in the project than before it goes public, I think that's really like the biggest difference here. You know, when a company is traditionally going public, this is after they've raised hundreds of millions of dollars. It's after they've kind of like established their community and their product and all the people that created value for them. But there's nothing really left to like give back to like the people who made it valuable, you know, outside of the early employees, which is still a pretty new, you know, trend over the last like 30 years. But I would say broadly, DAOs are good at like from day one, if you've contributed value to a network, being able to own some portion of that in the form of a token or an NFT, that's a really exciting premise. But I think you need to be very careful about when that gets introduced to the equation, because if you add a token into the mix too soon, you can kind of conflict things with a lot of different opinions, and it can get very messy very fast.
Gotcha. That's interesting. So as a GP, you would come into a company and you probably provide some advice and some consultation as to how they can improve business and productivity and XYZ, and maybe collaborate with different projects. One of the things that I think you're like a bit of a genius at is just community building generally, right? And so my experience up until this point, in this point in time, is that for a project, you know, from a practical sense, to find some foundation of community, it kind of looks like maybe starting a Twitter account, jumping in people's Twitter spaces, then starting your own Twitter spaces, and then pointing people to a Discord, and then maybe encouraging some engagement so that they can get access to a future drop or something like that. Is that kind of the current community funnel, if that's what you'd want to call it? And is that, do you think that's what is effective at the moment, or do you think there's other things that people aren't thinking about that are effective ways to create community? Because you've done that yourself. Like, you've got a huge following. What are some things that you tell people practically how to build a community?
Well, the way to build a community changes every single day. And so there's definitely not one playbook, and it's definitely going to change like every single week. So you just got to be paying attention to what that looks like. I would say like the core part of a community is to give a home for the most active members to share ideas with one another. So whether that's on Twitter, Telegram, Discord, whatever it might be, the platform it's on doesn't matter. It's just like finding a space that everyone feels comfortable joining and talking around and sort of facilitating that environment. To my same point about like DAOs getting messy as they get bigger, I think that communities work better in smaller portions. And so rather than trying to put, you know, 1,000 random people into a general chat in Discord and being like, go figure something out, it's actually better to like cherry pick like the top, you know, 1% of actors who are value added contributors and put them into a network together. And so to make that like very succinct and clear, a lot of the artists that I'm working with are using a tool called Guild XYZ. This is basically like token gated programming software where you can set up a chat group where someone who owns X NFT can join Y chat group. And in this case scenario, it's just like, hey, if you hold one of my catalog records or one of my sound records or one of my another block records, you can basically join this like token gated chat. And in that chat, I'm actually going to allocate some of my time and attention. And I think for a lot of earlier artists, you know, the idea of a token gated chat group was good, but like they didn't really know how to like engage in that. But what I think the bear market has been healthy about is that people who are engaging in these chat groups today are still like very active, despite like, you know, there's not really a lot of money to be made right now. And so people are just here to genuinely come and support. And I think that that's really valuable. And if I had to like dovetail this into like the Constitution DAO example, because I think it's a funny one to recount here, it's just propagation of memes. You know, it's just like finding a good moment or a good story to tie into. You know, this translates across any vertical far beyond music. But, you know, Constitution DAO I thought was funny because anyone can sort of rile behind this idea of like buying the Constitution. And that turned into, you know, it was like a 5-person Telegram group that we were in that then turned into this like viral meme where like people were YOLOing a ton of money. And I think the funniest part of that whole project is we lost the Constitution. We didn't win the bid, yeah. But everyone got tokens if you had participated in the project. When we lost, everyone decided to just like, okay, I'm going to redeem my tokens for the ETH, get it back, you know, wash my hands, no problem. Me and a lot of people I know were just kind of like, yeah, like it's just a fun token, let's keep it, like kind of like having V1 DAI or having like some, you know, the DAO tokens or something. And what happened after, and this is just a funny recount for the podcast that has nothing to do with anything we're talking about, is that the token ended up mooning after we lost the Constitution. And so the Constitution failed. The DAO completely did not accomplish its goals whatsoever. But because of the fact that there was such a strong meme that was created around this concept of buying the Constitution and putting money into a treasury, you know, the token ended up going up like 700% over like the next like week. And like all these Asian exchanges had like $500 million of volume. And I think that that incident in itself spawned this entire chapter of like people wanting to collectively come together to buy like really stupid things. But I think that the narrative of like put people into a chat group to solve some goal that feels like very unlikely was actually positive for the space, because it kind of showed people that if you can create the right story messaging around it and then have strong community leaders, like anything is possible. And I think that's something that's still very early in terms of music. And I think we're going to see a lot of different applications where that same premise of like use community-based governance to go and do things in an industry that feels very unimaginable for one individual is something that's very powerful to take away from like that project as a whole.
Speaking of community building as well, one of my favorite tweets that you've done was music NFTs exist so that artists don't have to make TikToks. I actually, I laughed at first, but then I realized the reality is that it's this very strange time in history where there are probably just as many people that are hyped on NFTs and watching TikTok as there are people that are looking at billboards and driving past and listening to the radio and listening to those promotions. So do you think that the entire future of successful music promotion is about Web3 ownership? Do you think that we'll shift to that entirely? Or like, are these traditional media spends, like are they a waste of money just paying for this billboard and getting impressions? Or is it all about the Twitter and the Web3 ownership now?
I don't think it's a waste of money. I think there's a lot to unpack here, so I'm going to take it from a couple different angles. So to really give context on that tweet, I was going to see one of my friends play a show in West Hollywood. You know, he crushed it after the show. Some of my other artist friends and I were getting dinner next door, and they were like, Yeah, I mean, like today we just woke up and just made TikToks for like 6 hours and that was our whole day. And like, we hate doing it, but we need to do it. And then I just kind of recognized in that moment, like that's a lot of artists where like they'll block off like, you know, 2, 3, 5 hours a week just to make content because it's like what the industry requires of them. And then in my mind, I was like joking with them. I was like, yeah, wouldn't it be great if there was a world in which you could just get paid from the people that love you to go and make more music that you love? And like, they're like laughing like, haha, like that would be like so crazy. And I'm like, dude, this is literally what music NFTs are, is like, instead of trying to have like a volume based eyeball game where you're making content to like hopefully hit a viral moment, you know, you actually like unlearn the idea that you need to have like mass impressions and instead start to focus like more directly on your core audience. And so I don't think that Web3 is going to replace, you know, mass marketing. I don't think that artists should not spend money on things like TikTok and ad campaigns because there is merit in that from like a top of funnel situation. But I think where people need to allocate more time to is like developing their core audiences. So like for the people that have actually gone into that funnel and like want to engage with them more and want to know who they are and sort of like build a relationship, a lot of artists just stop like at the TikTok and Spotify conversion. It's like, if I make a TikTok and you click through it and you go to my Spotify page, that's like the end of the relationship. But I think that's like still really high up. And most of the value is actually like much further down in the funnel. And I think the reason why Web3 is good for this is if I go and I find a song on TikTok that I love, I go and stream it and I like it on Spotify, and then I find out that there's music NFTs, I can collect that song and now I have an incentive to go out and promote that even further. So beyond like me liking it, if I own this NFT, it's a lot more likely that I'm going to tell my friends to go and stream it or play it or listen to it or share it or whatever it might be. And I think historically in music, we haven't had any way to like incentivize listeners to like want to go to bat for their artist. You know, I think the closest analog I could make here would be like Street Team. If you go and hang up flyers around town, we'll give you like 2 tickets to the show. But like, flyers aren't going up in value and there's no market for them, which is very different from music NFTs, where you can actually own collectible versions of songs. And in the event that those songs are successful, you also see some upside on that too. And so just to round that up, I would say, I don't think Web3 is for mass marketing. I think that all the existing platforms do a great job of that. I think Web3 is for developing a core audience. And if you can use your mass marketing strategies to funnel people down into your core audience, I think that that's sort of the stack that I think is going to work more broadly for artists as a whole.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's a good picture. That's awesome. So as I, maybe my last question, and I have to ask this, this is a change of tact a little bit here. So you seem to be a high functioning, well articulated human being. And so I think you have you've got some profound wisdom in this as well. And so I had to ask a question around this as well. So I noticed I think you mentioned the book Atomic Habits here and there, and you mentioned some of the schedule that you hold to accomplish all the stuff that you're doing and to get it done, to be here, talk to us, and then talk to the next person you're probably going to talk to in a minute. And so the question is, could you give the audience here just a little glimpse of what the grind has looked like? So people don't just think you've been, you know, just going to shows and it's just all fallen into your lap.
Yeah.
And then the second thing is, what are some of the strategies that you've put in place to actually be able to do all of the stuff that you do?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'd say that the broad idea is just like calculated investments into people who are doing very exciting things. You know, I'd say like all of my time is spent talking to people who are like motivating or inspiring me. When I'm going out to shows, I'm typically not going out just to like blow off steam or like get wasted or anything like that. Like, it's typically supporting an artist that I respect a lot, that I have a relationship with. And I would say broadly, just trying to expand like the standard deviations of my network. You know, I think that one thing I really challenge myself to do is like find new pockets of people who aren't related to one another, and then like eventually connect those people together. And so what my day looks like typically is like waking up, meditating every morning, which I highly, highly recommend, spending basically all day on calls like this, just sort of meeting new people and talking about these ideas and getting context on where the space is going as a whole. And then, you know, later at night, it's either deep work, which is me like writing theses or blog posts to help like formulate conviction around the ideas, or like connecting new networks together, like going to a release party or like setting up my own event. And basically just like putting people in a room to be able to like talk to one another. But like something I'll share just like very confidentially here, because we're deep in the podcast, is like, I don't really go to events for more than like 30 minutes to an hour. You know, like I show up, like I see the people I need to see. I like make sure that I'm there. And this is going into the strategy thing, is like showing up is like 95% of the battle. Like, I'm not accomplishing a lot when I go to like a concert or a release party. It's like the act of going to support someone and them seeing that you're supporting them is more valuable than you physically being present in that environment. So even if I have to drive an hour across town just to shake someone's hand for 5 minutes, that's a win to me, because I shook that person's hand and I was like, hey, I'm here to support you doing the thing that I know you love to do. And I think that that's kind of my broad strategy for Web3 and my like career more broadly, is just like consistently showing up, you know, outside of like any profit making opportunity, outside of any like intention where I'm directly correlated to something. It's just like saying, hey, beyond anything else, you know, if you don't want to work with me or do anything else like that, I'm just going to be there supporting you. And then when it does come time for them to think about like, who do I want to bring into the orbit, their mind's going to go to the person that was like showing up for them the most. And I think that's the thing that I would like really recommend anyone listening, is like, beyond trying to like create any value or doing anything crazy and trying to like work with someone, just show up. And I know that sounds like a really easy thing to say, but it's actually a lot harder than you think, getting out of your comfort zone and putting yourself in unfamiliar environments. But what started to change for me is like, when I go to these events now, I know, like, I like to say I want to be the common denominator in the room, like knowing the most people from as many different verticals as possible. And so when I walk into a room, I can kind of tap in with like 5 or 6 different people and have this network of people that I can really know and trust. And I very much like live my life as this sort of like bouncing game of like going from different pockets of people that I know. And I think that in combination with having a very good personal relationship with myself, thanks to things like meditation and not drinking and sort of like just having very good personal habits, it kind of leads to this very fulfilling life where I'm spending time with people that I love and hopefully getting to do some amazing work with them in the future.
That's so cool. I actually really resonated with what you said about maybe not staying for the full duration of a gig or whatever, because that's something I do as well. And I kind of have this philosophy. It's like I'll go and like, it was a great concert, and then like now I'm finished. Like, that was good, but it might not be finished, but I'm finished. Like, I'm ready to head home. Maybe my ears are ringing or something like that. People are like, oh, you didn't like it. I was like, no, I loved it. Like, I'm so glad that I went. Or maybe I watch a movie and I don't watch the whole movie, but it's like, I enjoyed the movie, but I'm just deciding that I'm finished. Yeah. But like, I guess in today's culture, it's like, you just sit there until you've consumed everything.
Yeah.
But
I mean, I would also say the same goes for like food or anything though, right? Like, if you're like,
exactly.
If I'm like 80%,
you don't have to eat the whole burger.
I'm like, scarf down the rest of the plate just to like finish it. Like, I'm like, I'm good. You know? And I think, exactly. The one thing that I would caveat there is like, it's one thing to just like show up to an event and like sit in the corner of a bar for 15 minutes and leave and be like, oh, I went, like, power to myself. It's like, when you are in that environment, like, I'm highly, highly active. I'm like meeting as many people as I can, trying to just like really affirm the relationship, the conversation I have. But once it starts to get to that point where you notice that you're not having like productive conversations, or people are just like blacked out, or like it's just not benefiting you in any way, shape or form, I think that's when I start to tap out. But I do want to say too, it's not like I only go to things because they like add value. Like, I have friends that I hang out with no agenda, and like, I'll go to see a concert just to see the whole concert. But I would say broadly, you know, I try and place myself as many places as possible. And like, when it does come to sort of like building habits for myself, it's just like reaffirming relationships with people that I really respect. And that's ended up, you know, leading to this very nice life path that somehow seems to just keep opening new doors along the way.
That's so good. And I can't relate on the food thing. Unfortunately, I have literally zero discipline on the food. So if it's in front of me, I'll eat it.
Classic. I was going to say that you and my co-host are exactly the same, but he jumped in and ruined my opportunity.
I like the diminishing returns thing. Like, it's sort of like, you know, you go meet someone and that's an awesome return on what you're doing, but just standing there and just like waiting, because I'm going to stay here for the whole thing. If you're looking at it from a financial perspective or like an accounting perspective, for example, which is kind of sometimes might be the case, it has diminishing returns, right? Like, what's the point of staying there for the whole night if everyone's just drunk and falling on the ground and doing nothing? It's like, I totally agree.
Yeah.
It's so good.
And I guess something that I just like add to that too is, don't try and like do things that only benefit you. I actually see this a lot in Web3, and I think it's something really important to talk about. Like, all the people who are doing the best, they're like constantly showing up for other people when it doesn't directly benefit them. So like, in between you having drops, or like in between you having a project or something, it's like, my goal is always to create value for someone else first before I ever ask them for anything in return. I think it's very obvious to see when someone's out there like very self-serving, just saying like, hey, like, use my project or buy my NFT or something like that. But what I would say is like, broadly, the artists that are doing really well with Web3 right now are the ones who are showing up to support others when it has nothing to do with them. So that when it does come time for you to sort of have your own collection or to be launching your own project, it's much easier to ask people to show up for you because you've already been there for them in the first place.
So true.
Well, Koopa Troopa, GP of Koop Records, $10 million early stage music company investor, music NFT connoisseur. Check out his weekly newsletter, This Week in Music NFTs. He's big on Twitter. Where can we find out more?
Yeah, I think you nailed it. I would say Twitter is where I'm most active, at Koopa Troopa. This Week in Music NFTs on Substack, cooprecords.xyz for the fund. And then I'm also starting to post some TikTok content. So if you want to stay up with like, ooh, what are NFTs and sort of go deeper on some high level concepts, TikTok at Koopa Troopa is where to stay up to date with the latest.
Love it. Amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you guys for having me.